and serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Practice. Talking about practice? Not a game. Practice. Spiritual success is gained by daily cultivation. If you practice for the day, then you have won. If you were lazy for the day, then you've lost. Self-cultivation is at the heart of spiritual attainment. Gaining insight and ability is not a matter of grand statements, dramatic initiations, or sporadic moments of enlightenment. Those things are only highlights in a life of consistent activity. Whatever system of spirituality you practice, do it every day. If it is prayer, then pray every day. If it is meditation, then meditate every day. If it is exercise, then exercise every day. Only then will you be able to say that you are truly practicing spirituality. This methodical approach is reassuring in several ways. First, it provides you with a process and a means to maintain progress even if that particular day is not inspiring or significant. Just to practice is already good. Secondly, it gives you a certain faith. If you practice every day, it is inevitable that you will gain from it. Thirdly, constant practice gives you a certain satisfaction. How can you say to yourself that you have truly entered a spiritual path unless you can look back on years of daily practice and take comfort in the momentum that it has given you? Practice.
I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Tarek. Man, we were driving to lunch and Roscoe made some comments about some observations just about the generation that's trying to get sober right now, you know, versus the past generations and some different attributes that may exist in the most recent generation we're in, and maybe even the generation before that. And I was thinking back to things I've read about and heard about in terms of the creation of Alcoholics Anonymous and, you know, coming about in the Great Depression, and the majority of people for the next probably 30 or 40 years that were brought to Alcoholics Anonymous, they came from, for the most part, a lot of stable backgrounds. People that were predominantly, they were churched. They grew up with a value system. They grew up with foundations. They grew up with structure. The world in general promoted much more stability, and the higher power was not consumerism. And so you fast forward to the past, like probably 25 years or so, maybe 35 years. It seems as if the world we now exist in is run on addiction. It literally is run on addiction. Everywhere we turn, there's new marketing campaign or ad campaign saying, you're not happy, do this, buy this, here you go, we'll send you 10 credit card offers in the mail. You know, there's money, you must spend it. You know, and then we have the onset of social media, so now we're just in constant comparison mode. All right, constantly, look at this person, they look so happy. And it negates, it removes this concept of happiness typically has to do with circumstances. If the circumstances in my life look a certain way, I am happy. And then when they don't look a certain way, I am unhappy. But we don't talk about peace and joy. Is it possible for your circumstances to look entirely like crap and for you to have a sense of peace and joy? Isn't that what we're after here? A sense of stability. But what do we live in? We live in the era of the cult of self. That's what we live in. The cult of self. Oh, poor baby. Are you struggling? Let's give you this little pill. And you just do the best you can because you're worth it. And everything, I mean, you are the center of the universe. Anything you say you are, you are. And that's the way we're going to operate. We just got to make sure you get yours. I mean, what happened to do for others? What happened to the sense of community? But I swear, in my opinion, the world we live in is everyone's out, for the most part, for themselves. You know? And then we've got this... almost like a facade around what community and sense of spirit is. So I was in the car a couple weeks ago driving with my VP and my operations manager. And I want to share something I do with you guys. And I mean, it may defeat the purpose of like the humility I use it for. But so whenever I'm by myself and I'm on an on-ramp or I stop somewhere and there's a homeless person there, I'm always going to do something for them, okay, by myself, because I know if there's somebody sitting in the car, it's going to be egoic, right? And so I do that, except when my boys are with me. And so a couple of weeks ago, I took them to the College Football Hall of Fame in Atlanta, and of course, that's downtown Atlanta, and there's a lot of homeless people down there. So we're walking out of the Chick-fil-A that's connected to that College Football Hall of Fame, and there's a guy that's sitting there panhandling. So I wanted my boys to watch me walk up to this human being and ask him what his name is, gave him $10, and I said, you know, I really hope you walk over and get something to eat, all right? And I wanted my boys to see me engage this guy, you know, it's just, that's something compassionate, I believe, that I'm going through right now. And when we walked away, I told my boys that that's a human being. He has a story, but the majority of these people walking around, they don't see him as a human being. They see him as someone who's lazy, that won't get a job, that could pull himself out of whatever hole he's in, which I don't believe to be the case. And I heard a man at a retreat in 2015, and it has stayed with me ever since then, that like, what if that's God testing you? That he has come down in the form of a homeless person to see if you'd stop and help one of his kids. And man, it touched me then and continues to touch me to this day. So we're driving down the road with my VP, and they're talking about this new thing called 3F. It's men who strive for fellowship, fitness, and family or something, right? And they're big Bible guys, right? And they're talking about, my VP is recommending to my operations manager that he should join one in Nashville, and it's about taking care of, you know, the community, and you know, you should, you know, God is involved, center of your life, whatever the conversation was, right? And we're driving in downtown Nashville, and then there's a homeless guy at the intersection. In the same breath that they're talking about this fellowship and being together in a sense of community, which if you really understand the message of Jesus and Muhammad and the Buddha, all of them, all the Taoists, the Buddhists, the Hindus, there is a sacred teaching of you help the people that need help. You help the less fortunate. And what I heard was, motherfucker needs to get a job. And then I started to realize that that's the world we live in. You know, backed by this nasty consumerism, backed by this addiction cyclone that we're in. And how do you deal with that when you got a whole generation of people coming into treatment that's what they grew up in? That is what they grew up in. It's like the tentacles are already deep, deep. And so it's sad, it can be a very beautiful world, and it can be a very sad world at the same time. So whatever choice you make, our big book lays it out in interesting language. And on page 53 in our big book, it says, you know, you've been crushed by this self-imposed crisis. You can't postpone it. You can't hide from it. And you have to go into this choice without any fear. It says fearlessly. You got to stare down at this proposition and make a choice. God is either everything or else he's nothing. He either is or he ain't. Whatever you choose to believe will be true. You can either choose to tell yourself a new story about God and move forward with that, or you can choose to tell yourself a story that's not going to help with the problem that you find yourself in right now. The irony of this all you know what one of the dangerous things about spirituality in the 12 steps is they work. Why am I saying that? They work so well that they pull you away from God. Because you start to get things. You start to get your family back. You start to get your self-respect back. You get your self-esteem back. You get some money in the bank. People are talking to you, and all of a sudden, all the things we've attained, all the gifts that this program and the relationship with God has given us, they get in the way of our cultivation of that relationship. They pull us away. They work so well. And it's just the reality. Brandon and I have been doing this a long time, and that's what I think he would agree with me, is that's what we observe. And it doesn't make any sense to us when we look at it. Why walk away from something or drift further and further away incrementally over time from something that saved our lives? Because when we showed up here and our butts were on fire and the monkey was on our back, the gorilla was on our back, we really needed that power. I needed to have an experience with God. I needed to have my psychic change. I needed to have a personality change, which were the things I hung on a little bit harder than this idea of a higher power when I first got here. And then the blessings come. And then we get pulled away because we don't need God as much anymore. God is, as Charlie used to say, becomes a minor league pinch hitter, right? Take a knee, God. I'll call you in when I need you. I got it from here. And so we struggle in that way. And so when I said, I can't remember if it was in the earlier session today or yesterday, that first surrender is so, it's such an effacement, right? What I mean by effacement, think of it like when you're driven by a fear and there is no reaction. There's no space between receiving information and then responding. There is just go, right? I'm just going to create this thing that's in my mind, right? Or avoid the thing that's in my mind. So there's no space there. And then effacement is very similar. Like that surrender, there was no space where I just decided to surrender. It just happened. It was the purest gift that I've ever received. Unsanitized in any way. But then every subsequent surrender has been different. There's a huge effort to need God now. And not just need God's help, I just need God. And there's a little bit of a difference, right? Because when I find myself needing God's help, I need him to do specific things in my life. You know, and now I'm not accepting God's will. I'm not asking God what his will is for my life. I'm telling him what it should be. So that's a stark contrast there. And so as we move from step two to step three, which I, you know, and that's my emphasis for this weekend, I want to read something out of the 12 and 12. Oh, let's see here. But suppose that instinct still cries out, as it certainly will. Yes, respecting alcohol and heroin and crystal meth and all these pills, I guess I have to be dependent upon God and AA. But in all other matters, I must still maintain my independence. Nothing is going to turn me into a non-entity. You know, sometimes I think that's why I struggled for a long time, you know, I'd say I live, you know, those first like 6, 7, 8 years, did my prayers, did my meditation. I was trying to practice the 10th step. A lot of times it was like I had God in my awareness in the morning, and then it was Tarek driven for the majority of the day, mostly on autopilot. Occasionally I do the exercise Brandon mentioned where you put your alarm clock on your phone to go off every hour on the hour. And when the alarm goes off, you observe, have I been on autopilot for the last like 58 minutes? Have I been completely identified with what I got going on in my mind right now? And then I stop and I remember God and I do a short little meditation. I say a prayer and then I move about my day. It's a pretty interesting exercise to do. And I feel like let's assume for a second we can pot the possibility of giving everything to God. That scares the hell out of us, right? Because what happens to us? Do we just vanish and evaporate? What do you mean? I got to take some credit. I can't give God all the credit. Yeah, we can. I think we can. At least we can have a perfect desire to do so and fall short. If I keep on turning my will in my life over to the care of something with a capital S or somebody with a capital S, what will become of me? I'm going to look like the hole in the middle of the donut. This, of course, is the process by which instinct and logic always seek to bolster the ego and so frustrate spiritual development. The trouble is that this kind of thinking takes no real account of the facts, and the facts seem to be these. The more we become willing to depend upon a higher power, the more independent we actually are. Therefore, dependence, as AA practices it, is really a means of gaining true independence of the spirit. And so one of the things I like to practice around the third step is that everything that's occurred in my life up to this point on June 7th, 2025 at 1:50 p.m. Eastern Standard Time has been the will of God. Every single thing. And so a couple of months ago, I had one of those profound conversations with my sponsor that immediately changed the way I have moved forward regarding the concept of what is God's will. And I've never been a guy that spends a lot of time trying to decipher the difference between self-will and God's will. I really have no idea, nor do I care to spend much time investigating it. I know what it means to be, I think we have one choice. The choice is either to cultivate a relationship with God or cultivate a relationship with self. When the choice is to cultivate the relationship with God, then everything going forward is about God making the decisions. And my thing is to understand through remembering I am in God's will, I am also surrendering to the moment. We hear it all the time. You know, there are no mistakes in God's universe. It's an easier way for me to live. Some people might say it ventures on like being apathetic or not wanting to take responsibility, but then comes the paradoxical nature of spirituality. God is everything, but yet I still have to live in this world as if I am responsible for the actions that I take in my life. I have to own them, and I have to make restitution when I need to. But my understanding that everything I experience is the will of God, that comes through me through my own experience with crack cocaine. So if you observed Tarek 17 years, 8 months ago, I would have fit a lot of the descriptions in the big book around what it means to be selfish and self-centered, right? I didn't care about anybody in my world. All I cared about was getting high. I would do anything to get high. I didn't care who I was stealing from or the impact it would have on the people that care about me the most. In our language today, that's self-will run riot. That's how you would have described Tarek. You know, he is rooted in the destruction of himself through his selfishness. All right. His addiction's taking control. He wants to get high more than he wants to stay sober and clean and all the things that we talk about. Right, but if you fast forward to today, and I look back over that period of time in my life, Man, that was God just slowly like stripping me down to be bare to create the opening. He brought me home that way. So how can that be self-will? I don't know if it is or isn't, guys. I'm not going to tell you up here. I've got an answer. I've got something. I've got a working conception that works for me. And so this idea of just like giving God all of the credit for everything, the good and the bad. The bad things that have happened in my life are also faces of God, in my opinion. 5 surgeries in my time here. A 9-month period in 2014 that about destroyed me. You know, married at the time, stepdaughter starts having seizures, our house gets burglarized, I got a kidney stone, I've got these 5 surgeries. I lost the ability to talk in one of the surgeries because they had to remove a cyst or a tumor from my vocal cord. The dog dies while my former wife was out of town on a girls trip, so I got to deal with putting the dog down. I gain a bunch of weight. I got to go through the worst depression I've ever experienced. Have never, not before getting sober or since, have I experienced a depression that put me in the bed with the blinds closed. Not wanting to get out of bed, the woman I was married to had to call my sponsor behind my back. She was so worried about me. And then comes the proverbial day when I'm like sitting and I'm putting this shirt on in the bathroom. It's one of my favorite shirts, and I've gained like I don't know how much weight I gained at this point. And I just ripped the shirt off like I was the Incredible Hulk, right? Because the shirt was so tight on me. You know, and I come roaring out of the bathroom with like I think at the collar of the shirt's still on me, but it's like ripped from like the seam of the shoulder. And I'm screaming profanities at God, and I'm telling him to F himself, and I didn't understand why he was doing this to me, that my problems were coming from God, and I was so sick and tired of it. And I remember I dropped to my knees, and I said, God, please help me. That's all I could do at that point. And that was what the might be the darkest period I've experienced, that 9-month period. It was rough, but I'm a soldier. I put one foot in front of the other. Never did I let up on sponsoring guys. Did not let up on prayer and meditation. Did not let up on going to my home group. Did not let up on service work. Just that's the way, guys, that's just the way I'm built. I can't apologize for that. And you fast forward, you know, that marriage falls apart. And I'm going to talk about this a little bit. I mentioned my father last night. I rebuilt a relationship with my father to the point where I loved that man after all the things that had transpired us growing up. I want to talk about it in the last session. And so I was taking care of my father while he was dying of cancer. And my marriage fell apart at the same time. So I was living out of a bag. You know, my friend Lindsay allowed me to stay in her guest bedroom. You know, when I was getting high, like, you know, prostitutes and escorts were a huge part of my story. I've never shared this in an open setting like this. And that I'm like, God's moving my lips right now this way. There was one night when I was staying at Lindsay's. I don't even think you know about this, but there's a block down in Atlanta called North Avenue and Boulevard. Anybody from Atlanta knows that block, okay? And so there used to be, you know, hookers around there. You buy dope down there. And so this one night I leave Lindsay's, and I'm not going to get high. You know, it was the other thing, right? And I went to every spot where they used to hang out, man, and ain't nobody out on that night. Ain't nobody out not that night. I remember getting back to Lindsay's apartment. I always tell the back end of this story. I leave out this beginning part. I literally almost crawled into that bedroom, and I laid in the fetal position on the bed, once again saying the same prayer. God, please help me. Keep me safe and protected. I didn't understand. I was coming unglued at the seams. And the next day seemed like I was a new person in a lot of ways. That thing wasn't there. Most people have that experience, and they draw zero. They go back the next day and say, "Yeah, that wasn't for you. I'm gonna go get mine." Right? That didn't happen to me. And I sit up here and I talk about these concepts. I mean, it is a waste of time. So I had that profound experience with my sponsor. I have this decision to make, and I'm trying, you know, there are times when I ask God to show me signs and evidence of which way to go. And sometimes I follow the guidance that I think. But in step five, this is very important. I want to share this with you. Another nugget in the 12 and 12 is this right here. Now, I hope I can find it quickly. It is worth noting that people of very high spiritual development almost always insist on checking with friends or spiritual advisors the guidance they feel they received from God. That's a good rule to follow going forward, even though we want to cultivate guidance and expect guidance. I get that. And so I'm looking for these signs and the evidence of how to make this decision. And I call Ralph, and he says, Tarek, it doesn't matter. You can make either decision, and both are going to be the will of God. What's important is that you know that God's going with you into each of those decisions. That's what's important, not which decision you make. Guys, that blew the roof off the top of my head. You know, I will never struggle again, I think, with like a big decision like that. Eventually, I'm just going to close my eyes, and whatever shows up first is the way I'm going. All right. And so I had another experience, and I'll share this. And this is how I know Mr. Elric here. So back in 2015, I was unhappy with my employer. I wanted a raise. They didn't give it to me. You know, I start toying around with the idea of opening up a recovery center. My former late grand sponsor was a guy named Mark Houston that passed away in February of 2010. I had access through my sponsor at the time who'd gone out to Mark Houston Recovery. I had all this, like, I had everything, the manual. I was like, man, this is such a cool program. I want to create something similar to this and put my little stamp on it. And so I started creating business plans, shopped it around, asked the guy out in Colorado. He didn't want to invest. I got a friend of mine to invest almost $150,000. It was, I think, like $135,000, $140,000. And we started it. We started this thing. It's called the Launching Pad Recovery. It was a highly structured sober living on steroids. It was a 12-step immersion program. And I thought I was going to just revolutionize the recovery landscape, right? And it just didn't play out like that, you know. I became very I had ideologies around medication, which I'm not going to talk about today, but after about a year and a half, most of the treatment centers around Metro Atlanta realized that I was really anti-med, because they would try to send me people on a bunch of medications. I'm like, I'm not bringing someone like that into my community. If I have a solid community, I'm looking after the community. The personal recovery of every individual in our community depends on the unity of the community. It's first tradition stuff. And so I earned a reputation of not taking meds. Then they found out I had an approved list of sponsors, right? Only if you were on my approved list of sponsors, you could sponsor the guys in my program, right? And so a lot of them were guys I sponsored or guys that were sponsored by me, but there was the occasional guys that weren't sponsored by me. So then we get this reputation of being a cult, right? In the 3 years we were around, you can vouch for this, we never had a client, because what we do, we'd watch a client for like a week, and then we would make a recommendation on who we think might be a good sponsor for them. Then we'd set up the initial meeting, and then they can come back and tell us that ain't going to work. And we never had a guy come back and say that ain't going to work. And so I had this recovery center, and then it got to the point where the only people coming to my recovery center were word of mouth referrals from the fellowship. No, none of the treatment centers were referring to me anymore. And so I eventually had to make the decision to close it. And I felt like a failure. I wasn't able to pay back that man his investment, not all of it, not nearly all of it. And I didn't understand, because you guys want to hear how I made the decision? I was praying for guidance. I was praying for direction. And one morning I come out of my meditation room when I was still married. I still have this framed in my office to this day. My stepdaughter at the time was 7, 8 years old, and she was drawing on every piece of paper around the house. So I go downstairs, her and Marcy, my ex-wife, were gone. They'd gone to school, and then on the table is a drawing. It's got a red box. It says, "Follow your dreams," with a bunch of hearts and stars around it. So I call my ex-wife, and I'm like, hey, why did Callie draw this? And Marcy had no idea what I was talking about. And so Callie's in the back seat. She's like, "Callie, why'd you draw this?" She goes, "I was supposed to." I had just asked God to guide me into the decision about whether or not I was going to leave a job making, well, I was making over 6 figures and starting and taking that leap of faith of starting a business where the buck stops with you. And I made my decision based on that letter. So when you fast forward 3 years and the business fails, you start questioning, like, what happened with that that guidance I got? Clearly, this was a mistake. And that sat with me, guys. It sat with me until September of 2023. Was it September 23? I can't remember. Yes, it was. Yeah. September of 23, I'm at a wedding, and I'm sitting in the audience. And I sit in one of the Brandon was talking about communicating with people with his heart. Whatever I felt was in like the spiritual heart. It had no mind. But I looked up and I saw the groom had been a guy that came through my program. Okay. I saw the best man was a guy that had come through my program. I saw that one of the groomsmen was a guy that had come through my program. The father of the bride had been my business partner. His daughter, you know, got sober around all these group of people, right? They're at the beach this weekend, right? I had to call them and, you know, tell them I was going to come see you. And it hit me that the launching pad had nothing to do with Tarek. Nothing to do with Tarek. I thought it was God's will. Maybe it was self-will. What I came to find out is maybe God created the launching pad just to bring those people together, because now they're married. There's couples that have branched out of that. They all have children now. They're all still sober, and they all were brought together for that. We really think we know what the hell's going on. We have no idea what's going on right now. And the icing on the cake is I'm sitting at a retreat last year with the man who was my investment partner. And I've been scared to tell him the story I just told you. And he said, "Tarek, if I had to do it all over again, I would gladly give you all that money if I knew this was going to happen." Yeah. I think it's the desire maybe to please God that pleases God. I do have that desire. So that's my take on step 3.
Some periods of growth are confusing, that we don't even recognize that growth is happening. We may feel hostile or angry or weepy and hysterical, or we may feel depressed. It would never occur to us unless we stumble on a book or a person who explained to us that we were, in fact, in the process of change, of actually becoming larger than we were before. Whenever we grow, we tend to feel it, as a young seed must feel the weight and inertia of the earth as it seeks to break out of its shell on its way to becoming a plant. Often the feeling is anything but pleasant. But what is most unpleasant is not knowing what is happening. Those long periods when something inside ourselves seems to be waiting, holding its breath, unsure about what the next step should be. For it is in those periods that we realize that we are being prepared for the next phase of our life, and that in all probability, a new level of the personality is about to be revealed. It's from Alice Walker. You know, we don't just have to seek it from spiritual people. There's people all around the globe that have taught us these things. So, my wife's in the middle of a relapse right now. And that's actually funny. because there was a period of time where she kept getting migraines, and I identified that she was getting migraines after she had a glass of wine the night before. And I tried to point it out a couple times that you seem to get these migraines the day after you have a glass of wine. And she assured me that it was just hormones and that it had nothing to do with the glass of wine. I didn't really feel like arguing, so I just said, okay. And then the next time she had a glass of wine, she woke up with a migraine. And I said, honey, I know that you think it's just hormones, but the last time that you drank wine the night before, you woke up with a migraine, and it just happened again. And she said one of the most fascinating things I've ever heard. She said, I don't know if it's from the wine or not, but I don't like wine enough to find out, so I'm just going to quit. And you know what she did?
Quit.
She quit. Save for a couple brief moments at maybe a glass of wine at Christmas, or we'd go to a wedding and she'd have a drink. We went out for our half anniversary a couple months ago because, you know, my mom was busy dying in the hospital during our regular anniversary, and so it kind of got overlooked a little bit. And so we were out, and I love it because, like, when she has that second glass of wine, she starts to whisper. And when she whispers, it's loud enough for Roscoe to hear, but she's whispering, right? And it's usually when we're at a wedding, it's like, oh, her dress is hideous. I'm like, honey, shh. She's like, I'm whispering. I was like, yeah, okay. And so we were out for our half anniversary, and she didn't particularly care for this other person's dress, and she was whispering to me, and I'm like, honey, you've had two glasses of wine. And she's like, what? And I'm like, you're not quiet. So she's remained dry since then, but she was at the store the other day, and I think they call them Smirnoff Ice or something like that. And she got a thing for orange creamsicles. Apparently they have a new flavor. And it's called orange creamsicle. And so she went and got a six pack of it. And guys, back to back nights, she's had one. And I know that she's in trouble because she's finishing them the same night that she started them. And I just said, are you going to have one tomorrow night? And she goes, I might. I don't know. So I'll let you guys know, because, like, when I get home tonight, it will have been 5 days. So we'll see if she's, like, spiraled or not. But pretty confident that there'll probably be at least two left, if not three, because that's kind of the heavyweight that she is, you know. So I've experienced the physical presence of what I'll call God one time. It was about a year-ish sober. Went and did this super long meditation down by the river. That night, I was all alone out in nature. And I was visited by a presence. Now, it doesn't look like whatever you think God is, but that's okay. I was visited. And I've never experienced that presence before or since. But I see God working all the time. One of the coolest experiences I've had in sobriety was, I think it was, it's a thing called Sober Bash in Augusta. And I want to say this would have been, I think it was 23. Is that right? 23. And I walked around this campground up on the lake with this guy who had 7-8 months sobriety, and at least 4 people, when they saw him, said, "Holy shit, I thought you were dead." Because the guy that was walking around with me, he was one of those. He was one of those that, like, it wasn't a matter of if, it was a matter of when. That wasn't even my favorite part. My favorite part was when his mom showed up. And she spent all this time thanking me for all the stuff I had done with her son and just praising God and all these things. And I accepted what she was saying because it was nice, but it was to see what restored to sanity looks like in another person's family member. And the gratefulness that she expressed. And now the really, really cool thing is that she's got another son that had watched this older kind of dumbass son struggle for years and years and years. And he might talk to another guy that he was shooting dope with and say, "Man, I am never getting sober because I've seen my brother try to get sober, and that looks miserable." And that guy maybe even stayed out on the streets for a couple extra years just based on that statement, right? And today, when I saw her through the window, all I saw was God and the power that that is. And so, yes, I haven't had God visit me, but I see God all over the place, all the time. And I don't ever really know where it's going to show up. I'm out of town a lot, and one of the places I go to from time to time is Greenville, and I always like to stay downtown. And I get out and walk, and they got a fair number of guys, homeless people on the streets there, and I'll acknowledge them just as a person, as one of God's children. I had a guy stop. He's like, "Hey, how are you?" And I was like, "I'm great." He's like, "Man, do you got any money?" I was like, "I do not." And I was like, "No, I just don't carry cash." And he said, "Can I ask you a question?" I said, "Sure." He said, "Why did you talk to me?" I was like, "Because you asked me a question." He's like, "Yeah, but nobody else pays any attention to me." He's like, "Why are you talking to me?" I was like, "Because you asked me a question." He's like, "Most people just act like I don't even exist." And I've had that experience so many times where, like, this is a child of God. Just like all of you are. You know, it's been a different weekend here. I can't really tell what's going on out there. For me, the front row is probably the most attentive front row that I recall ever having. But I don't think we've ever done one where first chair is first chair the whole weekend. Usually somebody gets in trouble and does something stupid like fall asleep on fire watch or something like that. And then, you know. But I really don't know where you guys are. And I don't know where you're going. I don't know if any of you are going to make it or not. And so I'm going to talk about some things that I've seen recently that I've applied to my life that have transformed some things that I didn't. Because I'm not getting a whole lot of clues from you guys as to what you need to hear. So I'm just going to talk about whatever I want to talk about. So my spiritual mentor, he's been dealing with rectal colon cancer for 4 or 5 years, somewhere in between there, and he's doing a lot of spiritual work. He's doing a lot of other stuff on it, and I don't know what that looks like going forward for him. But the other day, when we were there was a group of us together. He was telling us about this. He's married to this other woman who's also a spiritual entity that's like helps a lot of people. And he said to her, "Honey, I am so sorry." I am so sorry that my disease has occupied our time and our energy and our schedule for the last 4.5 years, such that we couldn't do all the things that we want to do and that we're supposed to do in this world. And I don't know how long I'm going to be here, but I'm just really sorry that this is what we've had to experience. And I'm listening to this guy apologize to his wife for a disease that there's no conceivable cure for in front of him other than to have faith and continue to do whatever work he's doing and continue to progress on the spiritual path. And to trust in whatever this power is, that whatever the power wants to do with him is what the power is going to do. It's kind of a completely different understanding of faith. And the humility that the guy has to have that conversation with his wife. And I live on a farm, and shit breaks all the time, and there's broken fences that need to be fixed, and there's always construction projects going on that produce materials, and there's always just piles of trash around, just piles of parts and things and whatever, and drives my wife nuts because she likes it to all be nice and neat and tidy, and she's very visual, and so there's these piles of trash around that she has to look at on a regular basis. That she doesn't have the capacity to pick up, throw in the truck, and take to the dump. That's under my job description. And I just said to her the other day, honey, I know it is important to you that those piles of trash get taken to the dump, and I know you hate to look at them. And I'm just so sorry that for whatever reason, I just can't seem to take care of them. Because all these other times where it comes up, it's like I want to defend the position and explain all the things that I do that you don't understand and appreciate. But in this moment, I was just in this level of vulnerability where I apologize for that. And all she said in response was, thank you for acknowledging it. And so it blows me away to know that, like, we in this room have before us a way out. And we could help people with that if we tried to find that way and to work that way and to figure it out and to do whatever it is that we're going to do. But there's all that stuff that we've got that keeps us from actually doing the work necessary to arrest this disease. And yet, there's other people who, like, it's testing my understanding of the seven-step prayer, because the seven-step prayer, the word that screams at me out of that is usefulness, right? And this dude that I know is more useful than at any other point in his life that I'm aware of. His ability to move power and to comprehend and to teach spiritual principles is greater than he's ever had. And this guy has sponsored some of the biggest powerhouses I know. And he's dying. And he can't do anything about it. And I look at him and I just wonder, he's useful. What the hell is God doing? And there's at least a handful or 10 handfuls in this room of people who are completely fucking worthless, that have nothing to offer the world, and they're still here and alive. How old's Bo?
10 years old.
10 years old. So he's been at all of these. How many people have pet Bo that you are aware of, roughly, that are now dead?
How many people have petted him that are now dead?
Yeah.
200?
200 people in 10 years. That dog that's around here somewhere, that everybody knows, whether you like dogs or not, he's around, you see him. He's watched at least 200 people come through this room that are no longer here. There's a guy out in Montana dying that is the most useful person I've ever met. Kind of seems a little bit weird, doesn't it? So, go ponder that for 15 minutes and come back at 2:50. 2:40. 2:40.